This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Thursday, April 18th, 2013. I'm Caleb Brown. The 1920s offer a great example of how governments could tax and spend when the will is there. Amity Schlaes details some of this in her new book, Coolidge. She presented at the Cato Institute last week.
I don't know who looked at the budget that the White House issued. I kind of had a Cyprus moment looking at it, particularly page 18, the right column, where it says something about 401ks and IRAs that I hadn't seen before. Did you see this? Maybe I'm wrong, but it basically said tax preferred accounts should be people should be able to save in their tax preferred account about $205,000 per annum. That seemed to the White House the appropriate retirement amount. So, I mean, about enough so that they would have $205,000 per annum, or a total of $3 million in such accounts. And then it didn't really say what happens when you hit $3 million in that account. Is it over? Do they take some of the money out? But it seemed to be more than just ceasing to contribute to such an account. And that really this one area ought to be governed by even more rules, and this one area of the tax-preferred account, well, we should kind of get used to the idea of the government hand going in, the greedy hand going into that area more than we had expected before. And I think there were two reactions of people who read this. And then the White House allowed that the government would get $9 billion in revenue over 10 years. That's not that much from this change, it thought, by restricting these accounts in some new way. And the first reaction one has is some of my money is being taken away because it will be taxed more aggressively if it can't be in this account, or will be have a penalty when I take it out in order to conform with the rules. But the second reaction one tends to have when one hears something like that is a sense of distrust. That was an area I thought you wouldn't mess with. I trusted you over on that, and now even there, you're going to take from me, reach into my pocket. And those are two different things. One is the number my tax bill will go up, the number that the government gets will change. That's sort of a math, a calculation that has to do with the number of the budget or the size of the government. But the second one is about trust, a civic problem. And of course, trust contributes to growth too. So this lunch, almost lunch, I thought I'd tell you the story. Can I grab that book? It kind of is my security blanket today. The story of what happened in the 20s, thank you, Marion, in relation to these two things. It's a little bit of a surprising story. Marion mentions in there that the tax rate got down to 24%, the top marginal rate, which, as you know, is below Ronald Reagan's 28%. Do you know the president whose rate was 24? It wasn't Calvin Coolidge, it was Hoover. So I'm going to talk about that. The story of the 20s tax experience is a tax triumph, but it's also a tax tragedy in some way for Coolidge, the president from 23 to 29, Hoover's predecessor, this 30th president of the United States. It's a real drama, and we don't usually have economic dramas, or we have them, but nobody else appreciates them. So what I like about Coolidge is, you know, mostly presidents are war presidents, they're commanders in chief, right? And we know that economics takes heroes and bravery. Coolidge was an economic hero for us. An economic commander in chief, an economic general, one who sometimes chose not to command and delegated to colonels, I'll talk about that, who refrained from commanding on principle of delegation, and who won his war because he was a good general in that way. He got the tax rates down to 25. He got the revenues up. The one takeaway about Coolidge for anyone, any year, any time, is that when he left office after those 67 months, he came in 1923 upon Harding's death and left in March 29, the federal budget was actually lower than when he came in. And right away when you're talking to students or policy people, they'll say, is that relative to GDP? Or is that real, Amity? You know, the sophisticated people will ask questions like that. It was real and it was nominal because they had deflation. And it was not relative to GDP, notwithstanding strong growth. Our project's called the 4% growth project. They had very strong growth in the 20s like that, notwithstanding increase in the population, notwithstanding anything. They actually shrank the budget under Coolidge. It's a little complicated story with a few twists and turns, and I want to say again, I'm grateful to Dan and Marion, my two good friends, and Cato, a very good friend to me of long standing, probably the third or fourth book I've presented here, for giving me this time. The story doesn't start complicated. It starts with an economic situation similar to our own in some surprising ways, early 20s. The debt of the country is much higher than people imagined it could be just a few years earlier from the war, so they go up $10 billion, $20 billion, towards $30 billion when they had expected the debt to be about $2 billion. The energy sector was doing great. People were getting automobiles, remember. There was inflation, though. Prices were too high, but the government wasn't admitting it was inflation. That's very similar to now. The Treasury Secretary of Wilson McAdoo rivaled our current Treasury Secretaries in his hubris about money and spending, and our current Fed. The taxes were already high. You know that I think Marion said that the taxes were in the 70s coming out of the war. There was a large spread between the price of municipal bonds and the price of corporate bonds, reflecting the fact that companies and individuals were fleeing. There was a capital strike. The tax sector to hide in the untaxed municipal bonds. This tax engine was rather inefficient. If you look in the charts, you can see that there were only 21 returns filed by people earning over $1 million in the early, one of the early 20s years. That meant a lot of people, there were more millionaires than that. A lot of people were hiding their money somewhere. There was abiding troubling unemployment. There were two groups that were kind of angry, seeking entitlements. Remember, the progressive movement is on the march, and in Europe there are outright revolutions, and a lot of the American soldiers coming home have seen the European Revolution, thought they might like to do something somewhat similar at home. The one group that's quite angry are the veterans. Remember how many people served in World War I? It was universal conscription. Remember there were no antibiotics. Remember that their wives did not work when these soldiers came home. So they came home in pain with the prospect of reduced employment not much help. And they wanted a pension, basically something like Social Security. That's the bonus that you've heard about. And the second entitlement group, I think I would call them that, are the farmers who wanted some kind of permanent equilibrating subsidy, especially as prices began to go up. So it's an angry country, right, that Harding and Coolidge encounter when they come in. There's very little voter trust. You don't trust the military very much after you've been through it often, right? The trust level, there are times when our country feels like a bad airport. That was one. This is one, too. Whereas this boarding pass is fake, I have to get another boarding pass. You go to the place with your boarding pass, and whoops, they won't accept it. It's that trust level. There were riots. Coolidge actually came to prominence because of the way he handled the riot following the police strike in Boston. He put it down with force. Very bitter moment. Driven in good measure, I want to add, by unacknowledged inflation. The policemen would not have struck had prices not gone up 50 or 60% while their wages stayed the same. What to do? Coolidge, temperament is part of the story. He was born in Vermont. His father collected the snow tax in his town, Plymouth Notch, a town where the railroad chose not to go. His railroad all over Vermont, but not Plymouth Notch. His father was the sheriff who took the people in the cart when they didn't pay their taxes, maybe to the jail, including people he knew very well. His father ran the schools and had to figure out how to pay the teacher. Very tight background of farming people in a place that the government later determined in the New Deal, so wonderful. The New Deal is wonderful. It determined that scarcely an acre of Coolidge's hometown, Plymouth Notch, was arable. They're farming there, but it's not worth it, right? So he was a tight type. And he knew from experience you had to hold on to pennies. And he didn't really like to risk losing pennies, either for the government or for himself. That was bred in him. And I was also, I would say, genetic, a personality. And the emblem of Coolidge's mentality vis-a-vis fisc, he was not a Jack Kemp. He was not a large, happy fiscal hero. He was tight. And the way you know, kind of the emblem that I found that suited Coolidge best, it was so typical Coolidge, was the White House got twin lion cubs from a mare in South Africa. Nice gift. Mrs. Coolidge loves animals. They love kitty cats, etc. The White House of the Coolidges, they named those lion cubs Budget Bureau and Tax Reduction. And they were even weight. They were fed with steaks and kept at an even weight. So there wasn't a big old lion called Tax Cut and a little bitty weeny runty lion called Budget Bureau. They were even. And that is the Coolidge personality as he confronts, you know, what they're going to do.
Amity Schles is author of Coolidge. You can watch the full event for the book at cato.org.